This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Digging Up Mother, A Love Story. Written by Doug Stanhope. Performed by Doug Stanhope and friends.
To Bingo. You're a potato head, and I know you'll never read this book. That's okay. I read you all the good parts out loud while I was writing it. Thanks for being there. I love you. You'd think I'd dedicate this book to Mother. Mother is dead and she doesn't give a shit. I'm not a man of faith, but I have faith in that. Of all the things you can't take with you, hopefully, ego is the first thing to be left behind. Since Johnny's not available to read this himself, I'm going to do my best Johnny Depp impression for the foreword.
Dear reader, he's a depraved, reluctant visionary and a debauched accidental guru who wears old suits that were likely once some old dead fucker's Saturday night prowling outfit. He's a man of the people who says what must be said, for no one else will. Total honesty, consequence be damned. No fluffy outside, no creamy inside. You get what you get and deal with it. He is our savior. For here in this life where the only guarantee is the ceasing of breath and a healthy death tax for our loved ones, he's the one man who dares to plunge the cold dagger of truth deep into the collective brain-dead psyche of our species for the ultimate benefit of all humankind. And certainly not since my dearest friend and mentor, Hunter, have I known an individual with such a profoundly strong sense of moral justice. It makes me sick, so I suppose I must ultimately admit that I do not like this man I speak of. I fucking love him. Him being Doug Stanhope. Signed, Johnny Depp, Los Angeles, California, 19 February 2016. Write it on your calendar.
After 30-some years of ruthless drinking, it's more than probable that I've fucked up a few details in this book. Maybe it was a year before, a year later, the wrong town, a different hole. But I've made every attempt to fact-check every story, and I thank everyone who took my relentless phone calls and emails to make this book as accurate as possible. I'm sure some of you never expected to hear from me again. Some probably didn't want to at all. Regardless, I couldn't have done this without you. A lot of people involved have grown into responsible adults with families over the years and have respectable professions. For that reason, I may have had to tone down a story or two on your behalf. Even if I wanted to smear you publicly, the lawyers wouldn't have it. And for that same reason, almost every goddamn name in this book has been changed. If you're reading about yourself and that's not your name, it's not because I got it wrong. They made me change it. I actually tried interchanging names. Molly Brown becomes Sally Jones and Sally Jones becomes Molly Brown. That way you'd still get mentioned just as the wrong person. Still, the lawyers wouldn't abide by it. If the story is graphic and true and horribly wrong and I could still use your name, that's because you are fucking blessed to have nothing to hide. You're proud of your scars and you have nothing to lose. There's still a few of us out here and I'm wealthy for still having you in my life. And since this is the audiobook, I wanted to add, I once listened to an audiobook read by the author and it was Naked Lunch by William Burroughs. And you could tell throughout the reading when he was going on the nod from heroin and then springing back. I will be drinking relentlessly through this audiobook. So, yes, sometimes I'm going to seem chipper, sometimes a little shaky, and sometimes a little bit slurry, as is everyone else involved with this audiobook. Enjoy! Chapter 1, Mother's Last Gasp. On Thursday, I get a call from one of Mother's caregivers saying, "I'm here with your mother. I think you should come over so you two can talk." She spoke like a mortician from a 1950s horror movie, so since I can't remember her name, I'll just refer to her as Morticia. But regardless, I knew that the call meant Mother was going to kill herself. There's no need to be mawkishly sentimental. I've been waiting for this call for a while. I'm not the "sit down, there's something I have to tell you" type of guy. I freak out at traffic and figuring out gadgets. I punch dashboards and I smash laptops. But when serious shit happens, I'm generally rational and grounded. And I ask, "Is it time?"
"Yes, she's ready to go."
"Now, as in today?"
"Yes."
And Mother's in the background wheezing out, "I've had enough." And we'd had enough false flags of Mother's suicides over the years that there's no immediate sense of panic. There was no panic at all. At this point, she was in terminal care. So much had happened over the last short period, midnight ambulance rides and helicopter medevacs, that we are happy to have her go for her own sake. She had no reason to be alive. Of course, at the forefront of my mind was the suspicion that this was just another Mother ruse. There was enough history with her to consider she might just be doing this for attention. Emphysema is not a disease that you can see. It's a horrific, suffocating way to die. You're drowning in your own fluids. It's like being endlessly waterboarded, but you can't tell how bad just by looking at the person. Mother wasn't waifish cancer patient with eyes bulging out. She wasn't cirrhosis yellow. She wasn't covered in sores like an AIDS patient. So although she was diagnosed terminal and no doubt withered, there was no way of knowing how much she's embellishing for effect. Mother was not above using her own impending death as currency for patronage. And I'd lost all tolerance for her scheming years ago, and now it wasn't necessary. She was dying, and I was going to be there for her in whatever way she allowed me. So I left my girlfriend Bingo at the house, and I made the short recon drive over to Mother's place. You could almost hear Gothic church bells toll as you opened the door into her tiny apartment and into the rubble. Morticia had a way of making things overly dramatic and hokey, probably in her own self-interest. Mother was in bed, and inside her 300 square feet of filth, cat shit, and clutter, she's now piled with an ER unit's worth of medical equipment. Morticia's playing the role of Sister Helen Prigent, head tilted in earnest sincerity. Mother was sat up leaning forward as if to vomit up an alien, eyes closed but very alert. See, I just read that part. See what I did, people? I just read that part. I didn't try to make it sound fucking natural, because that's where I was trying to get authory. So Mother leans up, "I can't fucking take this anymore." And even with the raspy smoker's death voice, she could always affect the tone of a crying child. "I'm sorry." "There's nothing to be sorry about, Ma. You've taken this for more years than I ever would, and it's all your fault." Morticia left, and Mother and I fell into a calm, calculated discussion of what happens next. And even though we're alone for legal reasons, we still spoke in silly, roundabout hypotheticals, like one of us might be wearing a wire. Well, if someone were going to end their life in a situation like this, they would probably want to blah, blah, blah. She knew that I couldn't know, much less assist, for legal reasons. She talked to a doctor that she trusted, and the doctor establishing that Mother was under hospice care. The doctor intimated that hospice was essentially a suicide machine, and if she were in that much pain, hospice wouldn't assist, but she would have adequate medication to make the decision herself. The doctor said 30 morphine tablets of her dosage would be more than sufficient to kill any human being, and she had nearly 90. So should she decide to do this, she wouldn't have to go out like Kurt Cobain, not that you'd notice the mess. I called her caregivers to make arrangements for transporting mother and her machines over to my house. Hospice agreed to deliver a hospital bed that we could put in the living room. Mother was a hoarder, and since she'd become unable to clean up after herself, her apartment was fucking vulgar. I'd long since given up on trying to talk her out of living like that, but I wasn't going to let her die in that mess. I went home and I told Bingo that Mother was on her way over and that, yes, indeed, this did seem to be the end of the line. We looked at each other comically and shrugged in the way that Butch and Sundance did just before they jumped off the cliff. How it goes from here, who fucking knows? If you ask me to plan a wedding, I'd at least know the basics of hiring caterers and renting a hall. But regardless of how okay we are with the concepts of death and suicide, I didn't know even the first steps of how to prepare. So we talked about hiring a birthday clown just for the pure satisfaction of watching him flounder. Too bad they don't have birthday clowns in Bisbee, Arizona. It was my only idea on short notice. Mother's clunky white linen hospital apparatus looked completely out of context with the carnival colors of the interior of our house. We dolled it up with multicolored polka dot throw blankets. Festive. She was wheeled as far as she could be, and then the few steps from the door to the bed took an eternity. And there she began to build her nest. A tray next to the bed was quickly filled with different pill bottles, a travel mug, Kleenex, and of course her cigarettes and ashtray for when she'd occasionally turn off her oxygen and smoke. I mentioned, and not as a joke, that she may as well go ahead and start drinking again. You can't take those AA chips with you. 2.5 years of sobriety down the drain? Fuck it! It was the first time she'd smiled since she made her decision. I went to the liquor store and I bought mini bottles of Kettle One and Kahlua. She was always a black Russian drinker back in her day, and I put them on the stand with her pills. I had plenty of large bottles, but this was just symbolic, and it brightened up her nightstand. I'd called my friend Betty, once lovingly and accurately described as the Edith Bunker of Bisbee, and I hired her as a nurse for Mother. I can co-host your launch into eternity without a blink, but there's no way I can deal with piss bags and shit in bedpans. Mother's run-on sentences and complaining are hard enough, but the idea of holding up her deflated ass cheek while she forces out a mushy yogurt turd, no. Betty was more than willing, almost like she was happy we thought of her for the opportunity. She lived just 2 blocks away so she could be on call. She didn't even want to get paid. We'd helped her with her long-shot failed run for mayor of Bisbee, but that held no candle to dealing with Mother, and there's no way I wasn't going to pay someone for doing a job that miserable. Mother didn't take to Betty, sniping and snapping at her both behind her back and straight to her face. She was fucking ruthless. This sweet lady who kindly agreed to wipe Mother's ass and change her Foley bag as a favor for a friend, and now getting berated at every gentle turn. It was embarrassing and entirely consistent with the woman that I'd now realized her to have been for the last several years of her life. No point in reprimanding her now. I don't know if I apologized to Betty verbally at the time, but I know I must have done it with my eyes. And to her immense credit, Betty never missed a beat, was never flustered or frustrated by the verbal abuse, like a veterinarian with a snarling puppy taking no offense, where I would have wanted to say, go fuck yourself, and hosed her down in the driveway like a messy baby. Mother, of course, arrived with cats. There was only 2 left at this point, down from many. Georgia was a decrepit 17-year-old, half-blind, matted with nicotine and her own filth, stinky dreadlocks hanging from her belly like stalactites. The other cat was a new arrival, a stray that wasn't so much rescued as ensnared, dragnet style, and incarcerated. There's no such thing as a free lunch, kitty. My house was more minimum security compared to the supermax of Mother's apartment, so the new cat lasted 1 night at my house before beating feet at the first opportunity of an open door and heading for the Mexican border. Mother was in no place to be accounting for cats, much less petting them. Thinking they were there was good enough for her. What Mother was more concerned with was all her shit back in her apartment. And it was all shit. She was a hoarder before they had a word for it. Once it had been at least somewhat clean and organized, if only by her own sense of organization, but as her health deteriorated, it became squalid. It crawled with spiders and houseflies, the floor littered with plates of cat food, her own food rotting in the refrigerator. Now she was at my place and she's terrified that I was going to go back over there and raise the place. She'd implore Bingo not to allow me to touch her things. "He's just going to want to go and throw stuff away and you can't let him." And then she'd identify different items that had to be kept. "A lot of that shit's worth a lot of money." "No, Ma, just because you spent a lot of money on it doesn't mean it's worth anything, and you can't hoard from the grave." As soon as she was settled in, I set down terms. "If you're indeed going to kill yourself, you can't do it on Sunday or Monday, because that's football, and I wasn't kidding. If you have the freedom to decide when you're going to die, it'd be downright rude to knowingly do it while your host has other events planned. And no loud parties." I turned on whatever shitty television she wanted to watch, and I tried to go about my day like nothing's different. I'm not much of a collector, but the one I do have is a wall of stolen clocks. One from the Man Show production office, one from the Girls Gone Wild tour bus, the Hammersmith Apollo backstage clock, and so on. And they were all on the wall behind the television facing Mother. And it wasn't until years later that it occurred to me what subtle implications that might have had. All day Friday, Mother drifted in and out of sleep, waking up to have me refill her 32-ounce travel mug with diet soda, eating very little, if at all, soft things like cottage cheese or yogurt. She's down to 79 pounds at that point. And she'd lived with back pain for years and complained about it every lucid moment. She complained about her now hardened breast implants, which on someone of that weight were like bowling balls on a skeleton. She'd had at least 3 sets in her life, and now hugging her was like hugging your grandpa with a boner in his sweatpants. It was obvious from her short, gurgling breaths that her body was struggling to continue. She was 63 years old, and she was a fucking mess. That being said, when Saturday morning came around and there'd been no more intimation of suicide, we started to think that we'd just have to wait the whole thing out. Obviously, I couldn't send her back to that toxic studio apartment, and in the unlikely event that she did last more than 2 weeks, well, that'd be a great way to fuck with my manager, Brian Hennigan. He's coming to stay in 2 weeks, and he doesn't have the spine for this kind of shit. Saturday afternoon, Tamar Halpern showed up at the house. Tamar had directed Mother in a few independent films back in Los Angeles and happened to be in Tucson. You'll know more about these people and places later. For now, just shush up. Mother's dying. Tamar had called Mother to say she'd planned to drive down to visit. She had no idea the condition Mother was in, and I felt a little bad for her. "Hey, I'm going to pop in for coffee, and the next thing you know, you're visiting someone on their deathbed." Still, Mother was thrilled to see her. Tamar was one of the only guests Mother had ever had in the 3 years she'd been in Bisbee, and their reminiscing definitely perked Mother up. It wasn't long before Mother launched into her customary, over-the-top, aggressive bids of hospitality, pushing Tamar to stay the night. "Come on, it'll be like a sleepover. It'll be fun." "Yeah, Ma, it'd be a fucking blast." Bingo and I wingmanned it so Tamar didn't get cornered and detained like one of Mother's cats. We had some cocktails during Mother's unconscious periods, and later on, all 4 of us watched Bad Santa, a favorite movie of Mother's and mine, together. Movies were always a great way of avoiding talking or, more often than not, listening to Mother. And when it was over, Mother was out cold, so Tamar could sneak out. When Mother woke up, she asked where Tamar had gone, as though she'd expected her to be there in her footy pajamas for the big sleepover. I told her she'd left, but sent her love, and Mother shrugged it off and went back to sleep. By now, Bingo and I are mentally exhausted from 3 days of spinning plates with caretakers, Betty, Hospice, Tamar, and of course, Mother. So Bingo and I split a bar of Xanax, twice what we'd normally take to sleep. Bingo lay down on the couch in the living room with Mother while I went into my office to catch up on whatever emails or MySpace or whatever the fuck was taking care of business back then. Somewhere around 10:30 that night, Mother yelled for me with a weak scream, "Ugh!" with the same demanding tone she had since she'd moved to Bisbee from L.A., and I gave a very abrupt, "What?" She doesn't hear me and calls again, "Ugh!" And I went in the living room, irritated, "What?" And she's lying on her side, facing away from me. "It's time for my pills and my drink." "Hey, how about don't say it like an asshole?" I grabbed her diet soda and her travel mug, and she said, "No," still turned away from me, "my other drink and pills." And it took a few seconds to sink in what she meant. And then I felt like a complete dick for being short with her. And not knowing exactly what to say, I just asked her if she was sure. She said, "Yes," scrambling for breath. And I shook Bingo awake. "It's time."
"Time for what?"
I said, "It's time."
"Oh, shit."
I started to move in three different directions like a fireman looking for a pole that isn't there. Next, I did the first thing anyone should do in this situation. Cocktails! Mother was always a Black Russian drinker in her early days before AA, but tonight she asked me to make them White Russians, her thinking being that the milk would coat her stomach for the pills. Amazing she didn't want to take them with chicken soup. I poured cocktails for the three of us while she took her arranged medications, and we talked for a while to make sure she knew what she was doing. I didn't want this to be an impulse buy, panic decision. She was keen on pulling the "I don't want to be a burden" card, which indeed she'd proven to be in the later years of her life, but not because she was dying. She was just a general pain in the ass. I knew that wasn't what she was referring to. I also made a conscious effort to not talk to her in coddling tones, as one tends to do when talking to someone this frail. "You're an adult, Ma. In fact, you're still my mother, making you the authority figure here. So, if you say you're ready, I'm not going to argue. I'm just going to look the other way, hypothetically." So with all the theoretical qualifiers and caveats out of the way, it was indeed time. Mother took what for her would constitute a deep breath and began swallowing morphine. I want to say she took them with cocktails, but seeing as she ended up taking all 90, I think that much booze would have killed her before the morphine had a chance. Regardless, it was a long process taking that many pills, and we were cocktailing the entire time. She became more relaxed as it went on, and eventually we were having what someone might call fun. Betty stopped by to check on things, decided it looked like this is a time for family, and left, saying she'd come back later. I called my brother Jeff and I told him what was up. He's aware that this day is coming. Years before, my brother and I had made a gentleman's agreement that when it came time, when our parents were in their last days, that he'd be responsible for Dad and I'd take Mother. Jeff lived near Dad and I get along with Mother far better than he did. I always had. And even though Dad was 18 years older than Mother, factoring in their lifestyles, it was pretty even odds on who's going to die first. Shortly after we made that arrangement, Dad was diagnosed with colon cancer. It went through him pretty quick. He wasn't a fighter. He's pretty content that he'd lived a full life. But while he's going through his surgeries, my brother would torture me with phone calls, whispering from a hospital room, "Guess what I'm doing? I just had to wipe Dad's ass after he shit himself. Stop calling me right now. Click. Ring. I just had to pick up Dad's dick and put it in a bedpan. Okay, you get the house. Leave me alone." So now I'm calling him to let him chat with Mother while she's dozing off into the dirt. Enjoy that for awkward. As she did with me, she kept looking for validation from my brother that she hadn't been a bad mother. He lied and assured that she'd been a fine mother,
I went the other way. A bad mother, you ask? Hell yes, you're a bad mother. How else would you raise a child to one day 10 bar while you're about to croak? Another round? Me too. No doubt she'd groomed me with this sense of humor from the beginning. Her Friars Club send-off was just the culmination. Once she'd finished the unpleasant project of getting all her pills down her tentative throat, there was nothing left to do but wait and make jokes. She was lucid for quite a while, ordering more White Russians like it was a Christmas party. I'd bring her a drink, lean in, and fuck with her. Hey, Ma, wait! They found a cure! And she'd laugh like someone coming out of a nitrous oxide haze, lifting her middle finger towards me. Hey, Ma, when you get to that place, if there's that kind of white light and there's some kind of way we can communicate, see if you can make the Saints cover 8 points at Oakland tomorrow. That will be our sign of the afterlife, like Houdini. Occasionally, she'd have us crank down her oxygen so she could have a cigarette. And at that point, Bingo and I had quit smoking for 10 months. But we'd schemed since Mother got here to share one last cigarette with her. Considering the prevailing circumstances, it couldn't really count against us. We even bummed non-menthols from someone in anticipation of it. And there's no better cigarette than that one you have when you break down and smoke after a long period of abstinence. And this situation removed any guilt from it. Now that we're all in our pints and in this situation together, we're doing whatever we could to make this fun and funny and comfortable for her. When I was a little kid, she'd always make me rub her feet. I bet she could remember the exact day when I decided it was gross and stopped doing it. But these were extenuating circumstances, so Bingo and I each took a foot and massaged it. We went through a litany of old fun stories. Same ones that she'd been repeating since they happened to us as kids, only now I had to act like they were brand new and still hilarious. It was like pretending to be on ecstasy without the wanting a fucker part. Mother was always funny on some level. Her Achilles heel was that anytime she got a big laugh, she'd always repeat the punchline ad nauseum until it wasn't funny anymore. And as she drank what was sure to be her last one, I said, "Wow, Ma, you're really hammering down those cocktails." And Mother, barely alert but perfectly intoned in a campy British accent, said, "There's times to be dainty and there's time to be a pig." And Bingo and I fell out laughing, and I could see Mother trying her best to follow it up and ruin it. I stopped her before she could. "No, don't say anything else. Those are perfect last words." And they were. Mother lay there in a smiling half coma while Bingo and I put on music. We cried a bit and sang louder than Mother probably would have liked, but she was in no state to complain. And I have no idea how long this went on. When my father was dying at my brother's house, I remember putting a mirror under his nose to see if he was still in fact breathing. And I'm pretty sure we did that with Mother as well. At some point, thankfully, Betty came back over, joining what seemed to be a party in progress, and confirmed, yes, she's still breathing. Betty, who was unaware of what's happening exactly, but knew me well enough that seeing us all in full swing at a party with my dying mother wasn't curious whatsoever. I guess I'd expected this whole thing to take 30 minutes based on absolutely no factual information whatsoever. Now it's been hours, and Bingo and I are fighting lots of cocktails and a double dose of Xanax to keep our eyes open. Finally, after Mother had been unresponsive for far too long, we collapsed on the couch next to her. Mother drank me under the table until the end. I woke up and there's people in the house. And as a drunk, I'm used to the first several moments of waking up being a cavalcade of confused memories trying to shape themselves like a game of Tetris. 6:30 or so in the morning, Betty's there. She's engaged in some sort of activity. There's two men who at first I thought were paramedics, but turned out to be from the mortuary. Waking up in a Xanax and vodka haze after just a few hours sleep, my mind's racing to work out the details of exactly what's going on. I got up to see Mother laying on her back with her mouth gaping open, just like my dad's had been. When I touched her face, cold saliva that had puddled in her mouth spilled over my fingers. Betty had showed up after we'd fallen down, stayed while we slept, and made the appropriate phone calls when Mother was no longer showing vital signs. She told us later that when the mortuary people showed up, they'd come through the back door and first spotted Bingo sprawled out across the sofa and assumed she was the corpse. And as they went to move her, Betty stepped in and pointed them the 6 feet away to the obvious hospital bed with the old dead lady in it. And she said they were mortified with their own gaffe. We still think it's hilarious. I don't remember anything after that. I know the Saints not only covered the 8 points at Oakland, they won the game 34-3, confirming Mother was in a better place now. And by that, I mean she wasn't all dead and drooling in a hospital bed in my living room while I'm trying to watch football. This is a love story. And that is the end of chapter one, and we have Betty and Bingo here. I know Betty because after Mother's death, it was mentally, we didn't remember exactly what the fuck happened. And I remember asking you, Betty, shortly after, like, who was here? Was Tamar here during that? And you told me some story that I remembered so differently, but I trusted you. And then I realized, don't trust Betty. She's more Daffy than any of us.
We were double up on Xanax at the time, so that's probably
we were Xanaxed out.
We don't.
And you were telling me no. It was during Bad Santa that she was eating Xanax, the morphine, mm-hmm. which made no sense at all. But I kind of believed you for a second because I don't trust my own memory. And then I talked to Tamar, who was here, and like. No, she's the rational person. That was Mother's friend that came. We watched Bad Santa first.
Well, Tamar wasn't there when we were watching Bad Santa.
Yes, she was.
No, she wasn't.
Yes, she was.
She'd already gone home.
You haven't finished the book. She wrote an entire screed.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe I took too much Xanax.
But we asked you to be Mother's nurse. That's why you get called Mayor Betty or Nurse Betty.
Because she's taken care of me a number of times as well. And I'm actually a zoologist, so there you have it.
So she's a professional. But at that time, your son was living 2 blocks away, and we asked you out of panic. Like I don't ask people to do much.
No, I was living in his house. He was in China. I was living there because I was running for mayor or something.
So it was like 2 blocks away.
Yeah, just 2 blocks away. Yeah, I was just living right there.
And she was so fucking awful to you.
If that's the worst that happens to me in my life, you know, that's a good day. So
it was so fucking embarrassing because Betty's like, you don't have to pay me. I'll just do it. So Thursday she came to the house. And
we moved her in, right? We moved her in.
Yeah, hospice.
The hospital bed in the living room.
Right in the living room, yep.
And you would come over and I'd leave the room because I don't want to see any kind of piss bag changing. But she would, I remember her being just rotten, like,
no, but think of her situation. You know, I mean, I didn't know your mother before that. And she was this independent, crazy woman. And all of a sudden, she's lying there. And somebody's got to clean her privates, you know, and wipe her butt. You know, I mean, I excuse her for that, you know. It's a horrible situation.
And you did at the time. I did not.
It's a horrible situation. Like,
I was mentally thinking, just die. Die. Don't do this to my friends. Just,
I mean, what a horrible situation to be in. So anybody that wants to be grumpy at that stage in their life, it's okay with me. You know, it goes like here and here and it's gone and, you know.
Well, here's the thing. Mother was she was younger than you are right now.
Yeah, by so 6 years.
When you say that stage of your life, don't picture an elderly person who doesn't know what they're doing. This was a 63-year-old woman.
But dying. But her blood oxygen was like 78 one day. You know, that's like she's drowning. It's like, you know, she can't breathe. Yeah. She's drowning and she can't pee and she can't poop and she can't feed herself.
What did he need you for?
No, of course he's gonna be.
She can pee and poop. She just can't make it to a toilet to do it.
You know, she's gonna be grumpy, you know? Let her be grumpy. It's the last thing she can be grumpy about. Let her be grumpy.
You're such a kind spirit to a detriment. So you spent 2 days dealing with that, and then mother cries uncle, says it's time to go.
Yeah.
You're in and out during that evening.
Well, she had it all planned out. You know, she had everything planned. She was a reformed alcoholic.
She had everything
alcoholic.
Ready.
She had reformed alcoholic for how many years?
She had been sober for, I think, 2.5 years at that point.
Oh, only that much. Okay.
Well, she had been sober for 20-some years.
Prior to that, yeah.
Then we moved around 2003. Four, she started drinking again. Then we moved here in 2005, and we had to rescue her from L.A. She had been through a few detoxes. She came here. She drank for another 6-8 months. Then she was sober from January 2006 to October 2008 is when she cashed in. But at that point, she'd been fucking life-flighted to Tucson and addicted to Vicodin. But she was fucked at that point. She was on hospice care.
Yeah, she had her oxygen turned up all the way, and she still couldn't get it to 80. You know, I mean, that's like
she still turned it off to smoke occasionally.
Yeah, she did. I'm surprised she didn't blow the whole place up by forgetting to turn it off or something.
So that day, Tamar came from.
Tucson.
She was in Tucson for a film festival or something. Yeah. Yeah. She came down. We watched Bad Santa. Mother's trying to talk her into staying over for a pajama party.
I honestly thought she left before the movie, but I blocked that out. You're right. You know, I can't remember her being there.
Oh, she was there for Bad Santa, and then Mother fell asleep, and Tamar got to duck out. And then at some point, she said, it's time. And she started eating all our morphines while we were making cocktails. And you showed up.
Well, she was eating them really slowly because she had enough sense to know if she ate them all at once, she'd just puke them up. And so I think she actually started taking them during the movie, but she was taking them slowly.
No, she took them slowly. It was after the movie because Tamar sat through the movie and then left.
Okay.
It was definitely, she went back to sleep and then she woke up and said, it's time.
Get
it's
my time. Drink. Yeah. Get it's my time. Drink and my pills. Yeah. And I assume she meant her diet Dr. Pepper
Bingo. And she had what, 88 morphine pills or something?
90.
90 morphine pills.
Yeah.
Took them all.
That's amazing.
Every fucking one.
I mean, I really respected her in death. I really did. You know, she decided that that's the best way to do it.
But it took a long fucking time.
Oh, it did. And that's when she was still awake that I decided I needed to just leave a little bit because you needed some time. And all right, I'm going to let
And your... you didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. And let me tell you, Doug, all your hard-ass talk... Doug sat there, held her hand, and sang to her for a couple of hours. Talked to her, sang to her. I know he doesn't want anybody to know that, but it's the truth. He's the tender-heartedest person at that moment that I've ever seen in my life. So sat there, held her hand, and sang to her all the songs that she used to probably remember. I don't know. So I left during that time, and I came back when she fell asleep.
When we fell asleep.
Well, you were still awake when
we were
I came
awake
back.
When
you were still
Betty,
awake.
Yeah.
Well, she fell asleep and there was no reason. She wasn't going to wake up.
It wasn't asleep, really.
she had fallen asleep.
She was tranked.
And Bingo and Doug were exhausted. And you went into a bedroom. I think you went into one of the, I think you went into the pink room. Yeah. You went into the pink room and
you're probably in the blue room on the computer.
I know I woke up. I had been in the blue room, and when Mother cried time, that's when we turned it into a party. And then after the morphine knocked her out completely, and we think she's dead any second. Nope. And then we started cranking tunes, playing Counting Crows, and Mother's gone. And then, is she dead yet? I don't think she's dead.
Breathing.
Yeah.
And she had no oxygen in her body. I don't know how she kept breathing.
So at some point we fell down and we wake up to you.
Yeah.
We fell down. We were both in the living room.
Yeah. And you next to Mother. And you sleep with the blanket right over your head.
Yeah.
Your blanket was right over Bingo's head. Doug wasn't anywhere around. He was in a bedroom. And so then, first of all, I called the hospice nurse because she had to pronounce her dead. So this went on all night. You know, she fell asleep. What time did she fall asleep? 1, 2 o'clock?
Mother?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably 2 a.m.
And so finally, you know, you guys are crashed. And I came back and maybe, I don't know, somewhere between about 6 o'clock, I called the hospice nurse, who I knew personally because she had... Everybody that comes to my house, a lot of them die in my house. My mother, my father, my uncle, Papa Doll down the road, they come into my house and they die. So I knew these hospice people. So she came in and we were surprised to see each other. And she was really nice about it. And, you know, she pronounces her dead. And so then the next step is to call the mortician who are ready. So they were coming in, and I told them, I met them at the door, and I told them they were going to have to go through the kitchen because they couldn't maneuver the gurney into the living room. And when they were still getting their stuff out of the truck, I stepped into the bathroom. I had to go to the bathroom. You know, I hadn't gone to the bathroom with all this activity bladder going on. So I step into the bathroom. I walk out of the bathroom, and here is the scene.
Oh, no.
And they come into the kitchen with the gurney and they're reaching for Bingo. And you can't see Bingo because she's got the thing over her head. Your mother's way on the other
meantime,
side of the room.
Meantime, there's a dead woman with her jaw completely open.
Way on the other side of the room.
Yes.
This is a...
4 feet away from me.
This is Bisbee.
Yeah, this is a...
That's the first
The entire house is 980 square feet.
Nothing.
So
that's
the living
first
room...
body they saw.
Oh, my God.
Well, if you had the covers over your head...
She had the cover over her head.
That makes sense.
And so that's the first... They came around the corner. It's the first thing they saw. And
I remember waking up very startled, but I didn't know, have any idea how funny it was or what was going on until I was told. But yeah, I was. Yeah,
I remember where I woke up, and it was in the living room in the far corner of the L.
She was in the far corner.
She was in the bed.
Yeah.
The big bed in the middle of the couch. I was in the far corner.
And so that's the first thing they saw. So I went, no, not that one. That one. They still laugh about it. I run into Rudy every once in a while at the gay 90s, and he still laughs about it.
Good. I'm glad they're laughing about it because that's fucking hilarious.
And you said they were powwowed outside afterwards, like shaking their heads in
they were embarrassment. Really, they were embarrassed, well, obviously. But everything went very professionally after that.
Betty, you are wonderful. I'm glad you were part of my mother's death. I hope you're part of mine.
I don't think I'm going to be here when you're... I think I might go first. So I'll have to make some arrangements with you.
Whoever goes first, let's hope they pick up Bingo instead. Right. And now, Chapter 2. Chapter 2, Not Your Average Mother. The majority of my earliest memories are blurred or deleted, but there's no forgetting the image of your mother jerking off the family dog. It wasn't even really the family dog, it was a stepdog, and we didn't like it. I was around 12 years old, standing at the top of the stairs at our new house in Paxton, Massachusetts, watching Mother lean down and go from a friendly belly scratch to a two-fingered tug job that neither me nor the dog were expecting.
She justified it by simply saying, well, they like it. I'm sure I found it awkwardly amusing because I was 12 and dog dicks are funny. Touching a dog's dick is gross, and your mother touching a dog's dick is far more gross, and gross equals hilarious. I don't remember the dog needing any counseling afterwards. I assume that's why you never see PETA protesting a Tijuana donkey show. So long as the donkey's pitching and not catching, it's hard to cry abuse. The dog belonged to my stepfather du jour, John Kirk, from whom my mother Bonnie took her name. My brother Jeff and I called her Ma, but would eventually refer to her as Mother, usually in the same grim tone that Seinfeld called Newman. Or sometimes as Mother, when the situation warranted, like when she's jerking off the cat in front of your friends and you're no longer 12, you're a full-blown adult and your friend is comedian Ralphie May. Or when she's telling your girlfriend's parents, unsolicited, about jerking off her cats. You know, situations like that. What? They like it, she'd still say. It's tough to pinpoint exactly when Mother started going weird. We grew up in a house on 20 Rich Street in Worcester, Massachusetts, middle-class neighborhood with a side yard big enough to play kickball in. Mother was evidently quite the drunk until she divorced my father when I was about 6 or 7, but I have no memory of her being sloppy or out of hand. I heard the story early on after my birth that a neighbor up the street, Rita Herbst, congratulated my mother and asked about me, the new baby. And my mother told her that I was the ugliest baby she'd ever seen. The neighbor tried to laugh it off. Mother insisted that she was serious. No, Rita, he's really fucking ugly. He's got blotchy skin and weird shocks of hair that go in every direction. Having a lifetime with her to judge by, I can fairly accurately chalk this up to Mother's insuppressible honesty, not any kind of drunkenness. I laughed when I heard it, and I laugh about it now, remembering her telling it. To this day, I've never heard a mother saying, demanding even, that her newborn was frighteningly ugly. I do remember Jeff and I making lots of plans and preparations to run away from home, including tents, survival gear, and that collapsible fire ladder to escape from the second-story bedroom. So it couldn't have been all summer days and lemonade. But that may have been just as much about us being shitty kids as from any lack of parenting. I had the proclivity to be an unruly little prick from the beginning. Strange early memories of taking a turd out of the toilet and putting it under my dad's pillow and then blaming it on Jeff, 2 years older and not nearly as adorable a liar. Another memory of putting one of my mother's sewing needles upright in the fabric, Another memory. I'll just fucking tell a story. Every time I stutter, I'm just going to tell a story. There's another memory where I put a sewing needle. She had one of those pincushion things. And I took the sewing needle that had the fine end and I put it on the couch right where she sat when she'd get up to get coffee. So she sat back down on the sewing needle and just fucking shot off of it like a cartoon. Ow! And she blamed me. And I pled my innocence, swore I had no idea what happened. I couldn't have been older than 4 or 5, and that's not the product of an alcoholic household. That's just straight up fucking evil. And I was clever, too. I remember crawling into their bed on a Saturday morning during cartoons to ask for money to go to the store to get cereal. Junk cereal, that's what I wanted, of course. And to upend me, they said that I had to read the ingredients and that sugar could not be one of the first two ingredients on the side of the box. I come back with whatever Count Chocula or peanut butter Captain Crunch, whatever I wanted, and then I'd feigned ignorance to the fact that not only was corn syrup actually sugar, but that it was not actually two different words, corn and syrup. Plausible deniability. I should have been a fucking lawyer. More remarkable here is the fact that in 1972, there was absolutely nothing odd about a 5-year-old child hoofing it down to the supermarket all by himself to buy his own groceries. The idea of that, with the added image of a kid reading the side of a box for nutritional information, slays me. It's weird that I picture the 5-year-old me wearing reading glasses at the end of my nose in that image. Mother divorced my father right around the time she quit drinking and joined AA. My dad always said the only reason she wanted the divorce was because it had become the fashionable thing to do, and later on, my mother confirmed this. My dad, Russell Stanhope, was my mother's high school biology teacher and married her when he was 36 and she was 18, or so went the story. Digging through old letters for this book, I now know that they were already a couple when he was 35 and she was 17, and still his student. Today, this would make him a sex offender and a felon. That might have clouded my perception that in reality, he was the kindest, most gentle person I've ever known. Go back through your own family tree, and you're not going to have to go far back to find relatives that would be now called pedophiles. Your great-grandfather that came home from the war at 22 and married your 14-year-old great-grandmother. Today, that war hero would have his head stoved in on the prison yard. Be careful how you react to buzzwords. If now I was informed that a sex offender were moving into my neighborhood, part of me would think of my father and consider that he or she would be a fantastic role model. My dad was anything but a predator. He was like a more lighthearted, less involved version of Richie Cunningham's dad in Happy Days. I wouldn't be surprised if my brother and I represented the only two times he'd ever gotten laid in his life. Initially, we stayed with Dad after the divorce, a task he was not well suited to handle. As much of a rotten kid as I was, at least Mother had some sense of discipline. She could be scary as fuck. One winter, she took our two huge toy chests and threw them out of our second-story bedroom window because we didn't clean our room. Jeff and I were always drawn to pyromania, and I remember my brother nearly burning down the garage with me stuck in the back of it while we're setting dead leaves on fire. Mother took him inside, lit a match, blew it out, and pressed it to his fingertip while it was still hot. She wanted him to know what fire felt like. And it sounds cruel, but you can argue her point. It certainly didn't kill our love of setting shit on fire, but it did instill the fact that we should never get caught by Mother. Dad was a complete soft touch. He was too aloof to catch you doing anything, even right under his nose, and if he did catch you, he was all Mr. Rogers. "Come on now, guy," was his disciplinary catchphrase. "Come on now, guy. You know better than to stand on the roof hitting wiffle balls full of lighter fluid and burning toilet paper into traffic with a bat." "Sorry, Dad." And that'd be it. Jeff and I ran amok. Dad had moved into the parsonage of the church, the house set aside for the minister that was unoccupied, and for the most part we stayed with him. Now, not only were we unsupervised most of the time, we also had free run of the entire, usually empty church as a playground. While I know they had joint custody, I don't remember much custody at all. The parsonage and 20 Rich Street were walking distance from each other, and it seemed like we drifted at will in between the two. We were monsters. I wasn't big enough to be a bully, but I did what a lot of weak kids did. I found someone weaker and paid it downward. On our tiny street, that kid was John Schaefer. Fake name alert! His real name sounds so much faker than the fake name the lawyers made me change the name to. John was 2 years younger than me and dumb as an onion. We'd send him to people's doors in the neighborhood saying that if he rang the doorbell and sang a song, that they'd give him a big bag of candy. Time and again, he'd belt out "Twinkle, Twinkle" and then stand there in painful silence, only to have the door eventually closed in his face. We'd get him to blow us behind the garage. We didn't even know exactly what that meant. He'd just blow on our dicks, and then we'd make fun of him for doing it. Mother came home once with John, fake name Schaefer, on a stool with a noose around his neck and the rope swung over a branch. She had to know that there were discipline issues. For God's sakes. Maura, fake name alert. Maura was my first little girlfriend.
and she lived just up the street from Dad's new digs at the church. There was a small field, giant in my eyes back then, behind the parsonage. And I remember us cutting through when Morris stopped me in a field and told me to kiss her. And I did, but no differently than you would your grandpa. And she said, no, kiss me like Captain Kirk. And then she taught me how to French kiss. So I kissed her like I would my grandpa, only now with my tongue sticking out. I don't know why I was so hypersexualized so young. No, I wasn't molested. I'm pretty sure Mora wasn't either. But we knew what fucking was, and we knew we weren't supposed to do it. But we tried to do it all the time in that church. It didn't feel like anything. 9 years old is way before your load-blowing years. It just felt like great mischief, like whipping snowballs at cars. It was a fun summer. I don't know how nine-year-olds break up, but I know that Mora wasn't my girlfriend anymore after we moved to Paxton shortly after. She'd still call me occasionally, and I remember her telling me that she had a new boyfriend now named Bart, and his dick was way bigger than mine. I remembered Bart because the teachers all called him by his full name, Bartholomew, and I was jealous that no one teased him about that stupid name since he was athletic and good-looking. And now I knew he had a bigger dick, and that's not something you should be depressed about as a 10-year-old. Years later, when I finally played in my hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts, at the sadly legendary Aku Aku Chinese Restaurant and Comedy Club, a girl named Susan Joy approached me at the bar and asked if I remembered her. She was someone we knew from Dad's church, and I had a vague recollection of her. Guess who I'm here with? Do you remember Mora? No fucking way. I couldn't believe it, and I would have bet that all of those memories had been whitewashed from her brain, but I'd have been wrong. Within the first three sentences of talking to Mora, she said, do you remember when we fucked when we were little kids? Yes. Yes, I do. I can't believe you remember. I got you to put your mouth on my dick and then peed. You started screaming at me and chasing me, so I ran out to where my dad was so you couldn't say anything. Oh, happy days. We laughed and we talked shit for a little while, short recaps of what we had done with our lives. She mentioned she was married now, and I right away assumed her husband was somewhere at the venue and said, oh, get your husband and I'll buy us drinks. And she said, oh, he's not at the show. Are you kidding? He's mad that I'm even here. He's afraid we have unfinished business. Are you serious? Your husband's jealous? We were fucking 9 years old. We're pushing 40 and he's at home pissed off. Oh, Mr. Big Shot comedian coming back to take what's his. Hey, Doc Hollywood. I've been that insecure boyfriend before, pacing around, staring at the clock. And every time my girlfriend doesn't answer the phone, I'm picturing her fucking some guy with fucking Jerry curls. But that was as an adult with an adult girlfriend. If you picture 2 9-year-olds fucking and the first emotion that springs up is jealousy, there's something very, very wrong with you. God help him if he ever finds out about Bart and his huge 10-year-old dick. I have no idea what I would say as a parent if I found out my kid was trying to have sex at 9 years old. I know I'd probably laugh. At least he's not trying to burn down the house. That's pretty much how Mother handled things. She could be vicious if it was warranted, but if it was funny, right or wrong, she'd fucking laugh. And that was always paramount with Mother, no matter how fucked up things might be. Humor was right there with it. Comedy albums, Bill Cosby, Bob Newhart, played a lot. I remember being tiny and repeating Bill Cosby's tiny little hairs routine to my father while he was shaving. I could do a mean Edith Bunker impression as a kid. Carol Burnett was a staple on Saturday nights, though I notoriously always fell asleep before it started. Farts and belches were applauded. Just stop setting shit on fire. Well, that wasn't about to happen. Burning shit and smashing beer bottles, that's endless free fun for kids who can't afford a big wheel. But like they say, it's all fun and games until your brother Jeff burns his face off with gasoline.
My dad was in charge of us that day at 20 Rich Street when we decided to take a G.I. Joe on his final mission. Across the street was a vacant wooded lot where we could burn shit with no one seeing. Jeff filled a paper cup with gasoline from a can we used to fill the lawnmower. G.I. Joe was outgunned. Before they could even drape a flag over G.I. Joe's molten coffin, Jeff thought it would be a bright idea to throw a lit match into the cup of gas, which created a tower of flame far larger than expected. Jeff panicked and stomped on the whole thing to put it out, triggering an enormous fireball engulfing him in burning gasoline until he doused himself out in the dirt. "Don't tell Dad! Don't tell Dad!" was all he could say. I told him I was going to get cold water. At this point, like getting JFK a Tylenol for his exit wound, and I ran and told Dad. It was bad. Jeff was hospitalized for 8 days with second and third degree burns and spent weeks after having to smear Silvadine all over his face, a silver-colored topical ointment that helps heal burns and also helps make you look like a hideous freak on a schoolyard where you're already unpopular. He still doesn't like to talk about it, and he'll be pissed that it's in the book. Mother went apeshit with the G.I. Joe incident. She was furious with my father for not being there, even though he was 50 yards away on a sunny afternoon. He couldn't have stopped it without having us tethered to leashes, which might not have been a bad idea. And she wasn't there either, and I'm sure she was directing most of her anger at herself towards my dad. She'd already made their divorce far uglier than it needed to be. There was no way to be mad at my father. He was always agreeable and non-confrontational, almost to a fault. If the blueberries came in well that year, it was a good summer. He liked bird watching, and he kept interesting insects on a pinboard. He'd press leaves and wax paper and label them. He taught at nature training school, where we went to summer camp. My father's primary state was contentedness. He wasn't cold and unemotional. He was warm and unemotional. His relationships were partnerships based on achieving shared harmony. Passion was uncomfortable and alien. Mother would convince me that he just swallowed his true feelings, and that was unhealthy emotionally. And it was far too long before I realized she was just being an asshole who couldn't accept that someone was actually at ease with themselves. We weren't going to be with Dad much longer. Mother found a guy named John Kirk in AA, and now we're moving to Paxton. It was only about 5 miles north of Worcester, but it was going to be a completely different and painfully shitty existence for the next 3 years. John Kirk was a fat ogre of a man who looked like a clammy Donald Pleasance. I'll pause while you Google image search that reference. He played that "when I marry your mother, I'm buying the whole package" card with such thin sincerity that he may as well have been beating us while he was saying it. He worked for John Hancock Insurance and brought all the joy and humor of risk assessment and comprehensive liability into the home. He was an ugly dullard and thankfully is now dead. Jeff and I were not thrilled with the move. Chapter 3, Paxton, Square Peg in a Sphincter-Shaped Hole. John Kirk had bought an eerie house right in the town square of the common. Paxton is a very wealthy town of about 4,000 high-dollar assholes.